matter. We're in a month to protect others.
Welcome to Books and Beyond with your host, Alison. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a
library. Nau mai, haere mai, kia ora, and welcome to our Books and Beyond Literary Lounge with Alison and Inika. Kia ora, Inika.
Kia ora, Alison.
Lovely to be back here in our other office, our second office. Now, look, on today's show, we're going to be talking about what we've been reading and what's on our to-be-read lists, and then we've got one or two or maybe three hot tips to share with you along the way. I know, we could just about do a whole show on them. Now, look, I wanted to jump into one that I've just been reading. It's really quite an amazing book, and it's called Permafrost, written by Eva Baltasar, who's a Spanish writer, and so it's been translated from the Catalan by Julia Sanchez. Now, Permafrost, it's a prize-winning debut novel that was actually a word-of-mouth smash hit in Spain when it was published by Eva Baltasar in 2018. Now, she's an acclaimed poet. She's got, I think, 10 volumes of poetry under her belt. So, first published in the Catalan in 2018, but the English translation has just come out this year, and it's a compact book, which you and I like. It's only like 128 pages or so, but it packs quite a punch, let me tell you. So now, Eva Baltasar has been described by some as a kind of like a Catalan Dorothy Parker. So she's witty, she's acerbic, ironic, and very caustic. So when I was reading all those words, I had a chemistry question in my head for myself, I guess. Is it possible to be acerbic and also caustic?
Yes. Now, that's a good question. Yes. It's not one to ask somebody like me who did not do well in science at school.
So, but maybe in, well, she obviously is possible, so that's cool.
I guess it is.
But maybe in the lab, it's not chemistry 101, but
we'll... Red?
Yes, it's the blue red. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So anyway, getting back to Permafrost, the narrator is a kick-ass lesbian who's quite inwardly focused, and her outer shell is permanently frozen. So I guess that's where the permafrost comes in. And so it's like there's no way of reaching that tender, warm core of her being. And now they never name the narrator, so she's remains unknown. But we follow her from her adolescence through to her 40s as she searches for meaning at home and abroad. Now, look, I do need to include a content warning here because all her relationships with her family, her friends, her romantic partners, etc., they're all fractured, and in parts of the book she questions whether life is worth living. And I don't really even want to describe... There's a couple of scenes that... Yeah, let's just say you want to be in quite a good space to go there.
Always good to know.
Yeah, I think it's quite good to know that. So anyway, in the search for meaning, she moves from Barcelona to Belgium and then comes back. Then she goes to Scotland and then arrives back in Barcelona. So there's this sort of search and the sort of desperation in some aspects. But ironically, her queerness becomes a salvation, and she slowly discovers the joy of being alive, basically. And also that she doesn't have to be bound by heteronormative drudgery, and that's the word she uses, and also sort of the emptiness of middle class values or the perceived emptiness. Now, I don't think I'm really giving away any plot details here, because there's plenty of action that I haven't mentioned. The book is amazing, I must say. But I don't think it's going to be everyone's cup of tea.
Sure.
But the prose is just beautiful. You can really tell that the writer is a poet. It's raw, it's emotional. Perhaps it's a bit too in your face for some readers. I was sort of thinking this morning, maybe it doesn't pass the mum test. I'm not sure about that. But it's bold, it's unapologetic, and apparently there's talk of a sequel to it, which could be great.
Is it a first novel?
Yes, it is.
Right.
First novel, even though she's
prolific.
So I'd love to see what comes next. And I was sort of thinking I'd probably recommend it more to younger readers, you know, perhaps millennial readers. But then, huge generalisation, because there's heaps of kick-ass grandmas out there. But if you want to challenge your worldview, this one's for you.
Sounds very good. And I think, you know, that shorter format as well does suit, you know, some younger readers who want to, you know, get a punchy read and then move on to the next one and sort of sit with it for a bit and then move on.
Yeah. I think so, yes.
That's good.
Yeah, it's been really well received.
Mm.
Hey, shall I jump over to my next one?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because this is also about a journey, basically a journey to finding your authentic self. And it's a beautiful book by the writer, it's a memoir by Kyle Mewburn, and it's called Faking It, My Life in Transition. Now it's just published. Now she's the prolific and award-winning New Zealand Australian children's author, and this is her first adult book, so her memoir, and it's an honest and emotionally powerful account of growing up transgender. So Kyle grew up in Brisbane in the 1960s and 70s and she describes a life that was much less sophisticated than these days.
Yes.
Queensland at the time was incredibly conservative, more so than it is now, mm-hmm. and harsh family life, not a lot of love demonstrated, and there were very few books available to a child who had this constant gnawing feeling of being somehow wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And she describes it beautifully, a bit like a children's, you can tell she's a children's writer, because mm-hmm. she says she felt like strawberry jam in a spinach can. Oh. And I thought, wow, doesn't it? Yes, it's just when your container's all wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So she describes a painfully awkward growing up period. The school and family life revolved around sport, and there were lots of playground fights at school and bullying and all that sort of thing. You know, it really reminded me of that book called 14 by Shannon Malloy, which is also set in Queensland.
Oh, yes, you reviewed that last year.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And very painful look at growing up gay. And even though Shannon Malloy would probably be 20 years younger mm-hmm. than Kyle, but from very early on in her childhood, Kyle knew that she was a girl in a boy's body. And it's so sad. She remembers lying in bed at night, sort of bargaining with God, mm-hmm. saying, "I'll be the best person ever if only you could change me into what I'm meant to be."
And it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Especially for a child having to go through that alone.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And so, of course, the bargaining with God failed. Mm. And so Kyle spent decades really trying to accept that she had a masculine fate, I guess, and all the while knowing that this was all wrong for her. But she does say that books and language saved her to a large extent. So anyway, Kyle travelled the world and met and married the lovely Marion in Europe, and they travelled the world, they're absolute soulmates, and they eventually settled in a small part of rural central Otago in 1990, and the population of their town is 200.
That is small.
Yeah, and they're still there. So I'd love to know what drew them to Central Otago after travelling the world. Mm. And then in the meantime, Kyle had become a very popular children's author, yes. as we know, through the libraries with, you know, those great titles like Old Who Who, mm. and then I love that one, Kiss Kiss Yuck Yuck.
I have that at home. We love that book.
Yeah. And so, you know, and this love of rhymes and puns and everything really sort of shows through in her children's writing, but it also shows through in this memoir. And now Kyle was in her late 40s, actually, when she finally said to Marion, I've got something to tell you.
Right.
You know, I'm transgender. So Marion has stood by Kyle, which is just wonderful, and they've sort of gone through the transition together.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really interesting that Kyle says nobody does this or claims to be anything for brownie points. She says there are no advantages to being trans. And I thought, what a powerful statement.
What a strength you have to go through that process.
Yes.
From, as you say, first inklings.
Yes.
All the way through the process.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's probably a process that ever really ends.
I wonder whether it, yeah, and even though it's taken like 55 years, but she's still in that process. Mm. Yeah, mm. as you say. It's a beautiful and powerful story. And I'd recommend it for anyone, really, to understand the human experience, but particularly the trans experience, and anyone that's maybe hidden from the truth about themselves and, you know, may not have discovered this freedom, really, in your authentic self. So highly recommended, very emotional.
Sounds wonderful, yes. Mm. Carl Mewburn appeared at the Writers
yes.
Festival with Lil O'Brien and Charlotte Grimshaw.
Yes.
All those powerful memoirs coming out in the
yes.
last year. We're just hearing some incredible stories, aren't we?
We sure are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So valuable.
Yeah.
Well, over the weekend, I finished a novel called, and I'd waited for it for quite a while because it's quite popular, book called The Mermaid of Black Conch by Monique Roffey. Now, this one's available in our adult fiction collection. It was published last year, so 2020. And I'll give you a hot tip right from the outset. It's also available in e-audiobook on Libby and Overdrive. And there's actually heaps of copies. And the beautiful thing about this book, which I think, you know, having read the book rather than listen to it, but I would like to listen to it again, it's got two actors playing the two main characters, and I think that really, I really love it when they have a little cast for an audiobook
yes.
rather than just one narrator. It actually really changes it up.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It makes it a different experience.
That's right. I think it would be perfect in audiobook, and I'll tell you why. So Monique Roffey is a Trinidad-born British fiction and non-fiction writer, and she's based in Manchester. Mermaid of Black Conch is her eighth book, so we have this one and lots of others in the catalogue. Now, I haven't read any of her other books, but I will be, having read this one. And I can't say whether this is usual for her writing, but Alison, I wanted to put a content warning in for here for you for magic realism.
Oh, no.
I
know. Thank you for warning me.
Well, yeah. I know you don't like a surprise when it
yeah.
comes to that fantasy real life overlay. So one of our main characters in the book is the elderly fisherman, David. Now, he's recounting a love affair that changed his life forever. So when he was a young man living on the fictional Caribbean island of Black Conch in the mid-70s, he had a fling, but this was no ordinary fling. His long-ago lover is a mysterious mermaid called Akea, and she appeared off the shore one day when he was relaxing with a smoke and his guitar on the shore, you know,
oh,
as you do
yes.
when you're in the islands. Now, hundreds of years before, Akea was cursed by the other woman in her village for catching the eye of their menfolk. Now, there is this thread of sexual jealousy and sexual power dynamics running through the book. Now, she was exiled to the sea and turned into a mermaid for her sin of being too desirable. Mm. Now, rather than blonde locks and the seashell bra that we usually associate with mermaids, she's got dreadlocks and tattoos that reflect her Taino origins. Now, the Taino people were indigenous to the Caribbean and Florida, and sadly, they were almost wiped out by smallpox and warring brought by Spanish colonists around the mid-16th century. Mm. So, Akea is an ancient soul. Now, David's totally fascinated by her. From his boat, he manages to kind of build up a level of cautious trust with her. She's curious about him and he's curious about her. But really sadly, this trust relationship leads to her getting into a really terrible situation. She gets caught on the hook of a white American fisherman and his son, and she's dragged back to shore, and she's strung up next to Marlon, and she's destined to go into a museum or off to the highest bidder. Now, David manages to rescue her while the ship's crew are celebrating their catch, and he takes her back home under cover of darkness and installs her in his bath.
Oh.
Now, once she's in a place of kind of relative safety and secrecy, she actually starts to return to a state of womanhood. Her tail turns back into legs. She has to learn to walk and talk again, and her sexuality begins to awaken. She was actually a virgin, despite her having been castigated by the woman in the village. She was a virgin when she was turned into a mermaid. Anyway, she begins to fall in love with David as this trust relationship grows between them. Now, David, in his turn, he's undergoing his own self-transformation. He really cares and nurtures and loves Akaya, and he learns to manage and separate his desire for her from the nurturing aspect of their relationship, and he waits very patiently for her to sort of make those first moves in the relationship to turning into a physical relationship. Now, there's a fascinating cast of supporting characters. Some are sympathetic and supportive of the couple and sort of maintain that secrecy around them, and there are others that are hell-bent on pulling them apart and really afraid and fearful of their differences, of her difference, I should say. Now, each supporting character really typifies a sort of particular aspect of that complicated colonial history and the politics and the different cultural identities that make up life in the Caribbean. This is a really singular, sensory, modern-day legend. It's got love and it's got loss. Akaya's passages are written in verse, and they're interspersed with David's journal entries recording his time back in that particular time of his life. And there's also a third-person narrative running through the book. You've got the sounds of the sea and the forest. You've got wind and rain howling around the house because it's the rainy season. And you've got the skank of Bob Marley and Aswad making up the soundtrack. So it's actually, it's a real sensory pleasure and experience to read this book. This book is also a real commentary on the dynamics at play and the potentially damaging forces of the pursuit of love and lust and power in this really culturally complex post-colonial landscape of the Caribbean.
Sounds amazing.
It really was wonderful, and I can't wait to read more from her.
Yeah.
The next book I am currently reading, so I'm only partway through, but I thought I would really like to have a chat with you about this one. It's called Caste, The Lies That Divide Us by Isabel Wilkerson. This is a non-fiction read from 2020. Isabel Wilkerson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and she's the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration, which was published in 2010, and it tracks the migration of black Americans from the South up to the North and all of the complex issues that came around that. Now, that particular book had a big resurgence last year as a result of the resurgence of the Black Lives Matters movement in the last couple of years. Now, Caste sort of carries on a little bit the research that was started there. It's a study into the continuing inequalities of race and class in America, and for black Americans in particular. Now, the main tenet of the book is that America is actually a two-tiered caste system, ranking the population into the hierarchy of white and non-white, with value assigned based on appearance and of skin colour. So it looks at the historical and the current issues in the US, including the period before the states was actually the United States. And it compares and relates it to the caste system of India, which has, of course, Brahmin at the top and untouchables, which they have now sort of not rebranded, but the caste of the untouchables is now called the Dalits, the downtrodden, at the bottom. She also compares it to the deadly legislative landscape of Nazi Germany, which actually took inspiration from the American eugenics movement and the Jim Crow laws of the South that came about post Reconstruction that legalised racial segregation and sanctioned violence and murder of black people and inspired Nazi policies that, you know, would have ultimately led to genocide.
Yeah.
Now, I'm only partway into the book and it is over 400 pages, so I've still got a way to go. But I'm finding her writing style really detailed but also very accessible. She uses some quite lovely metaphors to describe these complex systems and practices in a way that does really help your understanding. So, for instance, she asks you to think of the word cast in relation to the cast in a play where everybody already knows their role, their lines, and where they stand in the hierarchy and the social order. She also relates cast to the cast on a broken arm with the purpose of keeping everything in line and in place. Really interesting, yeah.
How interesting. Yeah, I'd say I'd never thought of the words
This is a really lovely, interesting way of putting it and kind of makes it quite clear. She also takes some time to look at marginalisation of Indigenous Americans. She looks at the Trail of Tears, which was a policy of forced relocation, which particularly affected the Cherokee Nations. And Andrew Jackson, whose policy of removal of Native Americans from their land was instrumental in leading to the Trail of Tears. And, of course, it meant that the dominant caste, as she would put it, gained the homelands of the marginalised people and were able to continue profiting from those policies that were put in place.
Because they got the good land.
That's right.
Fertile land where you could grow stuff.
And, that's right. Yeah. And Andrew Jackson was sort of deified for
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yes.
Oprah gave this one her ultimate seal of approval. It was on her book club list and she named it as possibly the most important book they've ever featured. So there's actually heaps of contextual content if you want to have a look at some of the information around cast before you dive into the book.
It sounds amazing, actually. Yeah. And I give it a lot of weight if, you know, with Oprah giving it her seal of approval.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because she's the right person to be looking at that and appreciating its value.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, look, it's sort of along the same lines, although it's a completely different style of book, but this sort of segues quite nicely. I've been reading this new crime thriller, actually, and it's such an interesting one, and it's called Leave No Trace by Sarah Driscoll. And at this stage, it's just available as hard copy in the libraries, but we've got this writer's other work in e-book form, so we'll probably will get the e-book, I would
say. The piece.
Mm. Yeah. Now, and it's an interesting one for a number of reasons. So I'll go through the reasons really quickly. It's the latest in a series called FBI K-9, which follows human scent detector dogs and their human
the dogs
scent.
Detect the human scent?
Yes, the dogs who
got it.
And their human handlers. So, so there's dogs are dogs and humans are humans.
Got it.
But each book in the series can be read as a standalone story. So the other reason it's interesting is that Sarah Driscoll is the pen name of actually two authors, which I've never been able to understand how they do that. But so the two authors, Jen Danner, she's a researcher of infectious diseases in Toronto in Canada, and the other author is Anne Vanderlan from Texas.
Mm.
And she works with therapy dogs, and one of her beautiful prize therapy dogs trains with her and does competitive nose work.
Now I'm intrigued.
Yes, so how interesting. I didn't know there was such a thing.
So interesting.
So she'll obviously knows all about the human scent detector dogs, I guess.
Right.
So I wonder if she writes those bits. But how they collaborate, it's a mystery to me, but
it's becoming more common, isn't it?
Yes, it really is quite a thing, isn't it? Now, this is perhaps where it compares to what we've just been talking about, because Leave No Trace is set in the state of Georgia, and it's a contemporary story about some reclaimed land that's earmarked to become a big hydropower system, and then the resulting controversy surrounding that. But there's a lot of historical detail that's sprinkled through the narrative about the Trail of Tears and, you know, the forced removal and relocation of the Cherokee Nation. You know, where, as you were saying, they were essentially marched to, at gunpoint to the new territory. And thousands of Indigenous people died along the way.
That's right.
And, you know, this was all so the white settlers could get the good land for growing cotton. Yeah. And she sort of, the writer shows that the scars and pain from this shameful period in the 1830s, they're still visible and still playing out today. So it's a fast-paced, suspenseful page-turner. A lot of present-day detail about contemporary Georgia, such as the racism, sexism, homophobia. Let's talk about gun rights or wrongs, hunters' rights. Bit disappointed in the ending, but it does set itself up nicely for the next instalment in the series. So,
Sounds good.
It was a good one, actually. It's a ripping yarn, with, you know, with a bit of substance behind it.
It's a bit of a murder mystery, is it?
Yes. Yeah. Yep, definitely.
Nice.
And those dogs do a good job with their noses.
Competitively, possibly.
Yeah.
Well, on my to-be-read list for this week coming is a book called Big Girl, Small Town by Michelle Gallen. It's a 2020 novel from the Fiction Collection. Now, I picked this one up because it sounded a bit like a cross between Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine and if you've seen Dairy Girls on Netflix.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Loved both of those.
Yes, that's right. But this one, I should say from the outset, is quite a lot darker from what I gather. Now, it's suggested that the main character, Magella O'Neill, is possibly on the autism spectrum. She loves her daily routines, doesn't like to break them, and she works in and exclusively eats from the local fish and chippy shop. Now, Magella has an alcoholic mother. Her father was disappeared, we think, as a result of the Troubles. And her grand's just died, I think possibly been killed, actually. Now, she's she doesn't really have close friends or a boyfriend. She is interested in sort of sleeping her way through the town a bit, but it's not really a romantic kind of pursuit. It's more about for her own ends, really. The book's written in the vernacular of small town Northern Ireland, so, you know, it's got that dairy girl feeling. I'd really love to see the audiobook in our collection. It's not there yet, but I hope it comes. It's narrated by the fantastic Nicola Coughlan, who stars as Claire Devlin in Dairy Girls. And she's also in Bridgerton,
Recently. Which is rather hot at the moment, isn't
it?
Yeah,
that's right.
Yes. Hey, look, I've got a hot tip for our readers. Do you ever start a book and then find that you're really not that into it?
I do.
Yes. And then what do you do? How do you decide whether to plough on and try and get into the story or just toss it aside? Well, there's this famous library algebraic equation that can answer and provide guidance around this dilemma.
Oh, do tell.
Yeah, so look, I think it's important for people to follow this. The number of pages you should read before guiltlessly ditching any book is 100 minus your age.
Okay. So, yes, like, and I've had a birthday this week, so I'm just rapidly doing the maths there.
So, I mean, it's another way of saying basically that life's too short to read bad books.
Completely agree with that.
But now, look, I designed another equation. I've killed the story because by saying I designed. Anyway, but the number, you know, if you, when your kids and your boys, particularly, and you want them to read and they go, no, I don't want to read this. Well, the number of pages they should read before they're allowed to toss it is, so you get 100, take away their age.
Okay.
But then you've got to divide it by Avogadro's constant.
Which is
6.023 times 10 to the 23. So, trust me, this works.
You lost me, Alice. I don't know how you're going to manage to get people onto that one.
But it's true. And as you know, I never make up anything.
No. Oh, absolutely the pillar of truth here.
Yeah, except for maybe at morning tea yesterday, I did make up a couple of things. But No, but trust me, that one does work.
Okay.
So I reckon you should get your boys onto it.
I will do my best.
Well, look, on that note, to our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in today. Happy reading. Use those equations, I tell you. So, and take care and be kind to yourself. Haere rā, ka kite anō.
Brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond.